91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we take a look into matters of race, courage, and forgiveness. After 50 years, it's still possible to feel the fear and tension of school integration during the 1960s. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Think of an ultra-Christian white teen who takes up the cause of black students, hand in hand, when they are enrolled in a small-town Georgia school. With those students, he as well endured the hatred, taunts, and beatings of segregationists. We'll speak with longtime Atlanta-based journalist Jim Ockmoody. He's written The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Topical Currents up next after the news.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. Well, this hour we revisit the school desegregation era of the 1960s with veteran Atlanta-based journalist Jim Ockmoody.
In his new book, he tells the story of Kenonia Farm and racial strife at America's High School in America's, Georgia, where four African-American students and one exceptional white student braved open harassment, hostility, bullying, and beatings to attend America's High School.
That's only the beginning of the story. Amazingly, it was continued decades later. Jim Ockmoody has written The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. And he joins us now from studios at Emory University. Welcome to you, Jim.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome, Jim. Thanks for joining us. You know, I'm really glad to have been introduced to your book and Kenonia Farm and all these events, but I couldn't help thinking when I was reading your book, it's been over 60 years since Brown versus the Board of Education, over 50 years since the Civil Rights Act, over 50 years since the Voting Rights Act, and almost 3 years since the Supreme Court invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act. But all that to say race relations and civil rights are still just front and center in our national conversation. Are you hoping that your book might shed some light on how we can address these issues regarding racial inequality?
Well, I think in addition to the laws being changed, the only real lasting change that ever happens on this front is when individual hearts one by one change. And a great deal of that has happened in the last 50 or 60 years. But race is one of those issues that's always disappointing us. It seems like every time we take two steps forward, we always take a step back. So it's something we have to keep coming back to and revisiting. This story that I've told here is one that in one way tells us about all the progress we've made and the possibilities there are, but in another way it tells you that there's a long way yet to go.
It was a voicemail tip that brought you into this incredible story. Tell us about that.
Well, I had been a reporter and editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for many years. I was there about 30 years. And in the summer of 2006, my wife and I were on vacation at Rocky Mountain National Park, one of the most beautiful places in the world. And I did a kind of unhealthy thing. I checked my work voicemail. And, you know, it's obsessive. That's the way journalists sometimes are. And I had a voicemail from a former editor of mine at the Atlanta paper who had gone on to North Carolina to become managing editor of a paper in Greensboro. And she told me this remarkable story of a reunion that she had just heard about. And it was about a kid who grew up in Southwest Georgia in the town of Americus, which is very close to where the Carters, Jimmy Carter's from, Plains. And he had been the only child from a very controversial farming commune called Koinonia. Today it's actually fairly well known as the birthplace of Habitat for Humanity, but back in the 50s and the 60s during the Civil Rights era, it was hated by many white people in that area because it was in favor of civil rights. And she told me this story about this kid from this farm who was the only child from this farm who was at America's High School the year it was forced to desegregate. And because of his support for civil rights and his support of the students, the black students who were desegregating the school, he was treated in many ways worse than they were during his senior year. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
Okay. Many years later, some of the people who had mistreated him in high school, who had undergone a lot of growth in their lives and a lot of changes of heart, they tracked him down in West Virginia, where he had been living for years, and invited him back to their class reunion and wrote him these beautiful letters of apology asking for his forgiveness, saying, "You were right, we were wrong." And when I heard about this story, I wanted to know all about it. I thought it was just a perfect story to sort of show how far we've come and how far we have yet to go. I knew about Koinonia. I've actually been to Koinonia a bunch of times and written stories on it before. It's got an amazing history of persecution and terrorism targeted at it that goes way back. So it didn't surprise me that a child from this farm would have been mistreated in the schools like this.
I was wondering, Jim, how come we've all heard about the struggles in Selma and Montgomery and Birmingham, Alabama, but I don't think many people have heard of the racial turmoil and civil rights struggles on Koinonia Farm. Maybe you had because you covered it at the newspaper, but the problems in Americus and Sumter County in Georgia.
Well, there was an amazing civil rights movement in Southwest Georgia that started in Albany, the largest city in Southwest Georgia, in 1961, and it moved up the road about 30 miles to Americus. And in 63, 64, and 65, there were mass demonstrations against segregation in Albany and in Americus. And in 65, it got quite violent in Americus. There was a person who was killed. The flashpoint issue was really voting rights, just like it was Selma. In many ways, what happened in Americus in the summer of 65 was like the closing chapter of the voting rights struggle that opened in Americus earlier that year. And I don't know why Americus isn't better known. The only thing I can figure is because there wasn't a photogenic confrontation like there was at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. You didn't have state troopers coming out in front of all the TV cameras beating people. Mm-hmm. So maybe because there wasn't as photogenic a moment, it isn't as well known. But I can assure you veterans of the civil rights movement know Southwest Georgia very well.
So do you suppose that movement in Southwest Georgia was an influence on Jimmy Carter and his commitment to human rights?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, everybody who lived in Southwest Georgia had to decide how they felt about civil rights because it came right into their backyard in 1961, 62, 63. Maybe I should back up and tell you a little bit of the history of Koinonia just so you can understand their place in all of this. Koinonia it's still there. It was a Christian farming commune that was founded in the 1940s by a white Southern Baptist minister named Clarence Jordan. It has a Carter connection. That is Hamilton Jordan, the Carter White House chief of staff. That's his uncle Clarence.
Right, right.
And Jordan believed in racial equality and pacifism and communal living at a time when these were really alien concepts in the Deep South. And a lot of people thought that they were funny out there on the farm, but they didn't really get a lot of direct harassment until the Civil Rights Movement came up. The people in Americus kind of regarded Koinonia like it was a nudist colony. As long as they were out there cavorting nude on the farm and didn't come parading naked down Main Street, they were kind of tolerated. That all changed in the 50s. After the Supreme Court decision desegregating public schools in 1954, the mood in the South among white people got pretty defensive and militant and resisting. And Koinonia got in the target because Clarence Jordan went up to Atlanta and endorsed several black students who wanted to attend the Georgia College of Business, which was all white. And by the time he got back to Americus, it was on the front page of the local paper that a clergyman wanted to desegregate the state university system. And that very week, violence started against Koinonia. There were drive-by shootings. There were bombings. People vandalized the farm, cut down their fruit trees, poured sugar in gas tanks. My main character, Greg Whitcamper, the guy who was the student in the subtitle of this book, who was at America's High School the year it was forced to desegregate, he was a fourth grader at the time, and he almost got shot. There was one night he was out playing volleyball with some of his friends, and the Klan came riding down the highway and took shots at them. There was a serious attempt to assassinate the Reverend Clarence Jordan, the founder of this farm. There was serious violence against these people. And it's interesting to note that it was all happening about the same time that similar violence was happening against Martin Luther King Jr. and the planners of the Montgomery bus boycott in Montgomery. And in fact, King and Jordan exchanged letters commiserating with each other and saying they were in each other's prayers. The black civil rights movement in Montgomery, the predominantly white farming community in Americus. And Jordan was later invited to come and speak at King's Church in Montgomery. They were fellow travelers.
Well, and in your book, King is imprisoned along with Ralph Abernathy when they came out after that Interstate Commerce Commission issued the ruling against segregation in the bus and the train stations.
King came down to take part in the Albany protests in December of 1961, and he was promptly arrested. And they were arrested. These were actually, in Albany, these were the first mass demonstrations and arrests against segregation in America. There were hundreds of people being arrested. And there were far more people than they could lock up in the Albany jails. So they started taking them to the jails in all of the surrounding towns and counties. And there was a new jail in Sumter County, where Americus is. And they took King up there he spent two nights in Americus in the jail up there. The sheriff up there, Fred Chappell, was a really nasty character, and he used the N-word left and right referring to King and harassed any reporters who wanted to try to talk to him while he was locked up there. When King got released and went back to Atlanta, he only half-jokingly told a reporter from Jet Magazine that he had just met the meanest man on earth in this sheriff down there. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Jim Alcmuti, veteran journalist. He's written The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. It's Topical Currents. We'll be back with more.
Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jim Alcmuti. He's an author, award-winning journalist, and editor. He spent nearly three decades at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's written The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Well, Jim, you've mentioned Greg Whitcamper. Let's talk a little bit more about him. He was at Thalian
Elementary school.
It was an elementary school, okay.
Yes.
Thalian Elementary School. His character and his youth and his... just talk a little about him, his relationship with his dad, and what his dad was like in that.
Well, Greg's family moved to Koinonia in 1953, very shortly before things got ugly down there, before the Supreme Court decision turned so much defensiveness against Koinonia. He came there... in 53, his father was a minister, a Disciples of Christ minister, who kept getting tossed out of churches because he was advising young people not to register for the draft. He was a pacifist. And in the 1940s and early 50s, I mean, this is, during the Good War and the immediate aftermath of that, patriotism was, at an all-time high. And a minister telling young men not to register for the draft, you would get kicked out of your church in most churches. And Greg's father heard about this community in Georgia where people believed in pacifism and racial equality and communal living, and those just sounded like exactly what he wanted. So he moved the family to the Deep South, and they had spent some time in Louisiana, but for the most part they were from the Midwest, and they didn't really have a lot of deep experience in Southern racial mores. Greg started at school in 53, and for the first 2 or 3 years in elementary school, it wasn't too bad. There were some people who mistreated him because they knew he came from that funny farm out there. But it was only after the violence started against Koinonia that kids started challenging him to fights in elementary school calling him a communist and things like that. After the violence against Koinonia during the 50s, it kind of died down after a few years, but there was a lingering boycott that almost killed the community. None of the area merchants would sell them farm supplies. They couldn't sell their farm products. They produced eggs, and they couldn't sell them to anybody. Nobody would do business with them because they were just politically radioactive. But after that, the conflict moved into the schools. In the fall of 1960, there were three Koinonia teenagers who were old enough to go to the high school, and they wanted to go to America's High, which was the best school in the county. And the city school board would not allow them to come in. They thought if these three kids from Koinonia, because it was so unpopular, would cause unrest and dissension. And they barred their way getting in there. And the Koinonia parents actually had to go to federal court to get admitted into the school. It's an interesting twist. Usually during this era, you hear about black students and parents forcing their way into the schools. This was a white kid who came from a community that was so unpopular, they had to go to federal court to get admitted. Greg started the following fall, in the fall of 1961, and it was a really bad time to be starting at the high school because that was actually when the mass protests started in Albany down the road. So the whole time that Greg was at America's High, the feelings among his white classmates about all the changes and all the protests that were happening were particularly high. And coming from Koinonia, he was mistreated from the get-go.
So then I guess we should jump to the four students, Jule Wise, Dobbs, Wiggins, David Bell, and Robertiana Freeman, who were now going to integrate America's High School, and what happened.
In 1964, the America School Board, this is after about 2 years of really intense protests in America's, they decided to allow a very token a bit of desegregation in an attempt to quell the unrest in the town. And they let it be known that they would admit a few black students, and there were four volunteers to desegregate. It's the four students you named. Greg knew all of them. Greg didn't have any friends among his white classmates. They thoroughly shunned him. But he knew all these black kids. To the extent he had a social life in town, it was among the black teenagers. He also knew them because he had been involved in a lot of the civil rights protests. He went to the mass meetings at the black churches in Albany and Americus, and he had taken part in some protests. And also, a lot of the protesters and a lot of the civil rights activists, they would go out to Koinonia. They used the farm as a sort of oasis, a place where they could get rest and relaxation. They actually had orientation sessions out there about how to be arrested in a nonviolent way. And Greg's white classmates knew all this. They knew that the activists were going out to Koinonia, so they regarded it as an enemy camp in their midst. So these four students volunteered to desegregate. At the beginning of the school year, in Greg's senior year, fall of 64, he asked if he could go to school, ride to school with them to show his support for them. There was a black funeral home that volunteered to take the black students to school in a limousine to try to forestall any problems that there might be.
That was kind of ominous in itself.
This is a
vehicle that's usually carrying people to their graves.
Right.
On the second day of class, Greg rode with three of the black students to school. And here's the scene. The limousine pulls up at the school. There are about 75 people waiting there. It is a smaller version of a Little Rock or Ole Miss scene. They're throwing rocks. They're screaming ugly words. They're just, in every way they can, they're trying to make it known that they don't like what's happening. And the limousine pulls up at the school. the sheriff, the one King called the meanest man on earth, he jerks the door open. And who pops out of the limousine first but not one of these black students? The white kid from Koinonia, Greg. Greg had already been despised, but this sort of kicked it into overdrive. He became the scapegoat, really, for all these changes that his white classmates resented. And he went through hell in his senior year. The black students were mistreated, too, but the school board took certain steps to try to make sure that a black student wasn't, you know, beaten up badly and didn't end up on the front page of the Atlanta Constitution. They had the black students come to classes 5 minutes late and leave 5 minutes early. No such accommodations were afforded Greg. He was on his own. And he was mistreated all that year. He was spit on. He was kicked. He was tripped on the steps. The people would urinate in his locker. They trashed his textbooks. He was physically assaulted several times. Nobody would talk to him except to make fun of him. When he walked down the hallway, it was like the parting of the waters. People would get out of his way and turn their back and just act like he was a leper. I'm sorry, did you want to?
I was just going to say, and during that time, how the rumors about him dating colored girls, but none of the white girls would even look up at him. They would turn their back when he would walk by.
Well, later in the school year, when they actually started when some of the white students were trying to sort of make sense of what was going on in their world and how it was changing, in their civics class, their afternoon civics class, there started to be a few conversations, and some of the white girls would ask Greg in a very aggrieved way if the rumors were true that he had dated some black girls, and they were most certainly true. He had. And he said, yeah, sure I have. You won't go out with me.
Right.
But there was one afternoon. Let me tell you about one afternoon that I think sort of was the climax of the of Greg's tribulations during his senior year. In the fall of 1964, there was a football player in one of his classes who accused Greg of tripping him in class and calling him a bad word, and he challenged him to a fight after school. Greg had been challenged to so many fights after school that he just didn't think anything about it. People were always telling him that they were going to whip his tail. Well, this day, when he was starting to walk to leave campus, about four dozen boys stepped in front of his way next to the baseball grandstand and surrounded him. And the guy who had said he was going to fight him, he walked up to him and said, put down your books, we're going to have a fight. And Greg said, well, I'm not going to fight you. I believe in nonviolence. I'm not going to fight you. And this football player, Thomas was his name, he hauled off and hit Greg in the face with his fist, right in the cheek, staggered him. Greg didn't fall, but he was really seeing stars. And what he did was remarkable. He stuck his chin back out to Thomas and said, Thomas, I love you. And Thomas just looked at him without any comprehension. His arms fell to the side of his body, and he didn't do anything else. I mean, what can you do? You've just hit a guy right in the face, and he tells you he loves you. Where do you go from that? You're just confused.
Yeah, he was so disarmed that no one, I mean, all the four dozen guys, and no one could do anything else.
He had also discussed it with his mother, what he was going to face that day.
He had discussed it with his English teacher.
Mrs. Craig. What was her name?
Mrs. Craig.
Her name was Gladys Crabb.
Yeah.
She was an English teacher who was in a kind of awkward position. She knew what Greg was going through, although she didn't know all the details. But she knew he was going through really terrible. But we didn't use the word bullying back then. It was really religious persecution. Today we might call it bullying. But she knew what he was going through, and she was very sympathetic to him. And she was actually pretty progressive on racial matters, too. But she also knew where all of these other students of hers were, and she knew what world they had grown up in, and that segregation had only ceased to be the law like about 4 months before, in the summer of 64. These kids have all grown up under segregation. So she was trying to comfort Greg at the same time she was trying to lead the others on. to their necessary journey of changing their minds about things.
The other thing was that Clarence, it's pronounced Jordan, right?
Jordan. Rhymes with right. Burden.
He actually, and he was a pacifist himself, and remember they had that conversation where he actually talked about fighting back finally, and sometimes fists are, or sometimes, you know, physical force is necessary.
Yeah, I love this anecdote. Greg was in the school cafeteria one day, and some guy acted like he wanted to be his friend and asked him to come sit next to him. And that was so unusual because Greg always sat by himself. People would move away from his table when he would sit down. But Greg thought, okay, maybe this guy just wants to make fun of me or have a debate, but I'll go hear what he has to say. And as he was sitting down next to the guy, somebody else threw a sloppy Joe at him. And Greg ducked, but he and it hit somebody else. But another, but he eventually ended up with sloppy Joe all over him, and he didn't clean up his shirt because he kind of wanted to everybody to see what he was going through. He kind of wanted to wave his bloody shirt. And when he got back to the farm that afternoon, Clarence Jordan, who was out doing something, he saw him get off the school bus and come walking down the road, and he mistook that orange, gloppy, sloppy Joe gravy stuff on his shirt for blood. And he came running up to Greg, and when he saw it wasn't blood, he just gave him a big hug. And, you know, he knew what the kids were going through. And it was a few days later that Clarence pulled Greg aside and said, I was talking to a friend of mine in Americus, and he had a situation like this in his life. And he said that everything got better after the person who was being bullied finally just hauled off and fought back. he fought back. And it makes me think that maybe this violence, this nonviolence thing, is really more for adults. Maybe for children it doesn't quite work. And you know, I've seen you out there working in the fields. I know you're strong as an ox. I know you could beat up any of these guys. So I'm just thinking that maybe, you know, if you feel okay with it, maybe you should just whip their tail.
We're speaking with Jim Ockmuty. We're talking about his book, The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Another break. We'll be right back.
With Tuesday's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jim Ockmuty. He spent 3 decades at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a journalist and editor. He's written The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Well, Jim, before, we don't want to, of course, end the show without getting to the letter. I mean, we have, you know, maybe 20 minutes left, but I want you to talk about Greg and his graduation from Americus High School.
Well, the harassment against Greg, his ordeal continued the rest of his senior year, continued right up until his high school graduation in June of 65. He angered a lot of his classmates because he attended the service with his best friend at the time, who was a black fellow named Collins McGee. Couple of years older than Greg, he was a civil rights activist, and he just happened to work and live at the farm out at Koinonia. So it was natural that Greg wanted him to come and see him graduate, but his white classmates were very upset that he would bring a black person to their service and in their view, ruin it. So when Greg's name was called to come get his diploma, most of the people booed. And then after the service, he and Collins were chased off the campus by rock throwers and name callers, very much similar to the beginning of the school year. But there was something else that happened at that graduation that sort of promised better things to come. One of Greg's white classmates, a fellow named David Morgan, who, as the year had gone on, had become increasingly troubled by the way Greg was being mistreated. It wasn't that David agreed with everything Koinonia agreed with, far from it. But he didn't like to see one of his classmates be so relentlessly harassed like that. And he had said a couple of things in class about how we ought to leave Greg alone. And at the service, David walked up to Greg in front of most of the senior class and shook his hand and said, "Congratulations, I don't know how you made it." And it was a very memorable thing to Greg because it was by far the nicest thing any of his white classmates had ever done to him. Well, many years later, you know, well, Greg after high school, he got out of Georgia. He went to college. He was in this remarkable program where he went around the world with this experimental college called Friends World College. Mm-hmm. He did a comparative study of world religions, going to Europe and Africa and the Middle East and India and the Far East. And he ended up settling in West Virginia after that and lived there, still lives there. He's been there for decades. And he had never heard anything from his classmates again until the spring of 2006. He went to the post office box near where he lives in southern West Virginia to get his mail, and he found an invitation to his class reunion in Georgia. It was a 40th class reunion, but they were having it a year late because they didn't have their act together. Greg had never heard from them. He had never been invited to a reunion, so that alone floored him. But in the same day's mail, there was a letter from this fellow who had shaken his hand at the graduation ceremony, David Morgan. And it's a beautiful letter. He asked Greg for his forgiveness and asked him to come back home. If I could, let me read the beginning of that letter.
Yeah, please.
I really love it. It says, "Dear Greg, I expect you will be quite surprised to hear from me. If you remember me at all, it will likely be for unpleasant reasons. I was a classmate of yours at America's High and graduated with you in 1965. I don't recall ever directly assaulting you, but I probably did to gain the acceptance and accolades of my peers. In any case, I surely participated as part of an enabling audience and tacitly supported and encouraged those who did. For that, I am deeply sorry and regretful. Throughout the last 40-plus years, I have occasionally thought of you and those dark days that you endured at our hands. As I matured, I became more and more ashamed and wished that I had taken a different stand back then. I knew even then that it was all wrong, yet I did nothing to stop it or even to discourage it." The letter goes on for quite a while after that, David agonized over that letter. He spent several days writing and rewriting it, and then he wrote it all out in longhand so it would be more personal. And Greg, when he read this letter, was so, he was driving back to his home in the mountains of southern West Virginia, and he pulled his car over on the side of the road when he saw David Morgan's name on this envelope. And when he finished reading the letter, he just broke down crying. And the most amazing thing was that it wasn't the only letter. Right. There were another 10 or 11 of them that arrived over the next several days from other classmates that were all variations on this theme. There was a remarkable letter from another classmate named Deanie Dudley, who came at it from a religious standpoint. She told Greg that she no longer had to ask anyone how the Holocaust happened, how those good Christians in Germany could have stood by and allowed something like that to happen, because in her own way, she was part of a crowd that enabled something like that in America's Georgia when she was a teenager.
And tell us about Celia Harvey and what happened to her, one of the other ones.
Well, Celia was one of the classmates who also wrote to Greg, and she had an interesting life experience. Her second husband was of Spanish extraction. He was Latino. And he was a little bit younger than her, and he grew up in New York and didn't understand what the racial situation had been like in the mid-60s in Georgia. And when she was getting ready to write this letter to Greg and apologize, she told him all about what she knew about what had happened back then. And he was just dumbfounded. It was just like, why did you do that? What kind of people were you? All of these people had experiences that in some ways had broadened their horizons. And the way this reconciliation came about was that David, who had been at the time troubled by what happened to Greg but hadn't really done too much about it, He was in charge of planning the 40th reunion. And this is something that had always bothered him. He thought it was a piece of unfinished business. And he reached out to about a dozen of his classmates who he thought would be of a like mind and said, would you be willing to write letters to Greg apologizing and inviting him to come back? So they orchestrated a letter-writing campaign, was what it was. They didn't know how to get in touch with Greg. They had no idea where he was.
I was wondering about that, too.
Well, what they did was Mrs. Crabb, this English teacher, who had been kind to Greg in high school, she still lived in America. She had taught at the high school for many years and had only recently retired. And a lot of them had stayed in touch with her. And so David got in touch with Mrs. Crabb and said, how do I get in touch with Greg Whitcamper? And Mrs. Crabb told me that she almost started crying when she even heard him say that, because it was something she had wished prayed for many years. And she knew how to get in touch with him. Actually, what she did was she called out at the farm, Koinonia, and said, where's Greg Whitcamper? And they, you know, gave him the address pretty quickly. And so that's how all these letters came there. One of the remarkable letters wasn't really a letter. It was a sketch. It was from the co-captain of the football team during Greg's senior year, a fellow named Joseph Logan. Joseph had been at the scene after school that day when Greg got hit in the face and mm-hmm. told his classmate Thomas that he loved him. Joseph witnessed that scene and at the time was so anti-Koinonia and pro-segregation that he really wanted somebody to hurt Greg. Joseph never hit Greg himself, but he very much was of a mind where he wanted to see Greg punished. And what he sent Greg was a very journalistic 3-page sketch of exactly what he saw that day out there. And the interesting postscript is that Joseph, who went on to become a college professor in Alabama and had a great many black students, which really changed his mind about things, Joseph told Greg that he had used that scene in his Sunday school class lesson several times in the United Methodist Church. He had told people about what he saw Greg not do that afternoon and how that was, you know, an example of Christian nonviolence in action.
We're speaking with Jim Ockmoody. He's written The Class of 65. And if you want to join in the conversation, perhaps you were familiar with America's Georgia and Koinonia Farm, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. We'll take our last break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jim Ockmoody. We're talking about his book, The Class of 65. Jim, oddly enough, reading the book, America's Sumter High School is now 90% African American.
Oh, yeah. It changed very soon after Greg graduated. America's was one of those places that had a segregation academy pop up in the late 60s, and the majority of the white students ended up going to that. But, you know, that's kind of what's happened with education in a lot of the country. There's been resegregation like that mm-hmm. all over the place, not just in America's. I mean, it happened where I grew up in suburban Atlanta. It's a fairly common story.
Do you know if first of all, we want to say that only one of the black students ended up staying there and graduating, correct?
Robertina Freeman.
Okay. Yeah. And her father was the head of the NAACP or at that time, wasn't he, in America's?
Yeah, Robertina is the only one who stuck it out. She was a really good student. Some of the other black students actually had trouble with the coursework. It's like when they got to the white school, they found out that the supposedly separate and equal education had indeed been separate and unequal. They were behind. Robertina was a really good student. She was able to hack it, and she's also a very personable and tough-minded person, and she was able to withstand all of the harassment that she went through. The stories of the black students are interwoven in this
right.
narrative, Robertina in particular, because she stuck it out.
And it, ironically, her sister, I think it is, turned out being the principal at America's High School.
Many years later, her sister became principal of America's High School, and Robertina was invited to come to an assembly there and make a talk, which she didn't really want to do, but she reluctantly did it. And after she talked, this white teacher came up to her in front of all the student body and said, "I was one of those people who used to laugh and make fun of you when you were here in school, and I was so wrong, and I am so sorry, and I just want to welcome you back to your alma mater." That story is told in the epilogue of the book, and it's a remarkable story because it's happened so infrequently. For the most part, the black students who went to America's High School in the early years have not been extended the same offers of reconciliation and forgiveness that Greg Whitcamper was.
Why do you think that was?
Well, It is. I mean, I've talked to a number of people down there who, you know, some of the black students who were in the school in those early years, and they say that they run into people every day or every week in America's who mistreated them in high school, and they just kind of look past each other. I don't know if it's because the white people have forgotten or whether it's because it's probably just something that's kind of painful and embarrassing, and why would you want to revisit that unless you couldn't avoid it?
Did you have any negative reactions to your book from people in Georgia, particularly Southwest Georgia?
I'm sure there's some people who don't like it, but the reaction in America's in particular has actually been very good. We did a talk down there. Greg and I did a talk down there at the library in America's. At the time, they didn't have a bookstore. They have one now. But it was very well attended. Several of Greg's white classmates came. One of them is actually pictured on the cover, at least half her face. She was funny. She said, I'm on your cover, half of me. And all four of the black students who desegregated the high school came to the thing, too, which I was very proud of. Robertina actually came to our first thing in Atlanta and the thing in America, so she came to both of them. She's a really neat person.
And talk about where they all are today, these four black students, because you write a little about where they each are. And, well, Greg and Greg got together with three of them.
Well, when Greg got these letters and started talking to his white classmates, he wanted to know what happened to these black students. None of the black students, incidentally, were members of the class of 65. They were all under class. There were two juniors and two sophomores, so they wouldn't have been involved in this particular reunion anyway. But there have been a lot of other reunions in their classes that they have not been invited to. Greg tracked them down and talked to them and had dinner with some of them. And I was at one of those dinners. I was working on the book by that point. Dobbs was a successful businessman who's retired back to America's. Jewel Wise is living in America's, too. And David Bell worked in the Georgia State Corrections Division for many years, and he's actually come home, too. He lives between America's and Albany. It's interesting how they've all come back home.
Really?
Robertina lives in Middle Georgia. She lives in Warner Robins, or actually in Perry. She was the director of the pharmacy at the hospital in Warner Robins for many years and is actually one of the most successful graduates of that high school in the 60s. She's the chairwoman of the State Department of Human Relations. She knew the governor down there and got an appointment and has done very well for herself, just recently retired. She's thinking about writing a memoir herself, and I think she should. She's got a great story to tell.
Yeah, she does. I mean, she was really brave and tough, and, you know, her father gave her the choice, really, who I think you said was a reverend, or was that
He was a minister.
Yeah. Minister, okay. And he gave her the choice to be one of the four almost experiments that were going to integrate this America's High School.
And she so totally jumped for it because she just wanted to go and make some white friends. She thought that she was such a wonderful personality, and she is a great personality, but she thought all these white kids would just love her because she was just, how could you not? And she was wrong. Let me make one more point about the book before we finish up here. This book is very balanced between the first half of it is very preoccupied with the ugly things that happened in the Deep South 50 years ago and gives you a lot of details about a perspective on that you probably have not seen before with this farm, Koinonia. Mm-hmm. But the second half of the book is very, very much more about how these students, these children of segregation, went from being the kind of people who thought Jim Crow was just to being the kind of people who could write these letters to Gregg. So it actually is something that we don't see a lot in books about the Civil Rights era, which is how did minds and hearts change?
You know, Jim, it's amazing because when you think about these students, at times during reading the book, I almost felt badly for them because they were a product of, it's what they learned. You know, some of them, if I remember, one of them's parent was in the Ku Klux Klan.
Correct.
This is what they learned. This is what they were taught. And for them to come around the way they did is the amazing thing.
One of the most moving things in reporting this book for me was when I stopped by to see David Morgan at the bank he was working at in Perry, Georgia then, and I interviewed him, and I asked him if he would read his letter into the recorder for me, and we were going to put it online with a newspaper story I did initially for the Journal Constitution in Atlanta. When I was sitting in David's office hearing him read this letter that he had written to Gregg, David has a thick as molasses South Georgia accent. I almost started crying because there was nothing that demonstrated to me more vividly how far he had come than hearing that accent say those words.
Mm.
This story seems to have great movie possibilities. Have
Absolutely.
You been approached?
We've gotten a couple of casual nibbles, but you know how movies are. That you know it. You don't believe it until it happens. I think it's very cinematic too. I think it's a movie.
It reads like a screenplay, to tell you the truth. It's so cinematic.
Well, I write in scenes.
Yeah. Is there still more to be written about this? We just have about a minute left. It seems like there's still a little bit more that could be said and a little bit more follow-up and with these people. And, of course, we haven't told about Gregg's. Okay, I know, Jim. We have to go. Okay. Jim?
Well, we really haven't talked about the reunion, but I know
right.
we don't have time to.
Right.
So you need to get the book if you want to see how that happened. It's uplifting, but it's not all roses and happiness. There's a limit to what reconciliation can do, too, and this gets into that.
Well, I just want to mention for Joe that Jim Achmoudi is also a food writer, and he's writing a book
barbecue
on the history.
Yes, I noted that, too.
I'm going to Memphis.
Have you back on Food and Dining Thursday.
Yeah.
I'm going to Memphis this afternoon, and I'm going to eat some barbecue.
Oh, boy.
That's one of your favorite barbecues, isn't it?
Dry rubs, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jim Achmoudi, author, award-winning journalist, editor, and he has a James Beard Award for his food writing, spent nearly three decades at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His book, The Class of 65, A Student, A Divided Town, and The Long Road to Forgiveness. Jim, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. If you'd like to hear more, we have free audio archives at our website, WLRN.org. Go to Radio, then Topical Currents. Also find more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Our producers, Richard Ives and Polly Landis, Paul Leary handles technical concerns, as well as the online presence for Topical Currents. So tune in for tomorrow's program when we feature the outstanding and award-winning South Florida choral ensemble, Seraphic Fire. We'll speak with its founder and conductor, Patrick Dupre Quigley, as well as its choral master, James K. Bass.
Who's a bass singer.
Yeah.
So it's a little confusing.
Musical examples as well. Stay tuned. This is Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Here and Now, next from NPR News.